It is Monday, December 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President-elect Donald Trump's tweets about Taiwan are affecting China's view of him. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers rejects an easement for a controversial pipeline in North Dakota. Activists vow to stay in the area.
These people have no intention of leaving. I think they're going to stay even with the winter weather just to make sure that all these promises are kept.
And rapper Kanye West struggles with health problems. It's all ahead. U.S. President-elect Donald Trump, who broke with precedent and accepted a congratulatory phone call Friday from Taiwan's new president, Tsai Ing-wen, Sunday, on his Twitter account has raised new questions about the direction of U.S.-China relations. Mr. Trump said, "Did China ask us if it was okay to devalue its currency, heavily tax our products going into their country, or to build a massive military complex in the middle of the South China Sea? I don't think so." The People's Daily Monday dismissed the charge that China is a currency manipulator or is militarizing the South China Sea. It said it shows Mr. Trump's ignorance of China. It warned against an irrational and hasty get-tough-with-China policy. Saturday, the Chinese Foreign Ministry lodged a stern representation over the Tsai-Trump conversation. The state-run Global Times chalked it up to the transition team's inexperience, but warned any breach of the One China policy would be disastrous to bilateral ties. Since 1979, Washington has maintained only unofficial ties with Taiwan, which China considers a renegade province. Sunday, on U.S. television, Vice President-elect Mike Pence sought to downplay the phone conversation with Taiwan's leader.
I think the conversation that happened this week with the president of Taiwan was a courtesy call. Mm-hmm. She reached out to the president-elect, and he took the call from the democratically elected leader of Taiwan. And it's one of more than 50 telephone calls that the president-elect has taken from and made to world leaders.
Meanwhile, Bonnie Glaser, senior advisor for Asia and director of the China Power Project at the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty she expects Beijing to intensely engage with the Trump transition team in the coming days.
To figure out whether he was in fact signaling any intent to change U.S. policy toward Taiwan, or whether this was, in fact, nothing but a phone call. And I think they will try to educate him about the sensitivity of the Taiwan issue and the complexities involved. But we don't know, really, what Trump's intentions were.
Vice President-elect Mike Pence on U.S. television Sunday said Mr. Trump was simply responding to a courtesy call from the Taiwan leader, along with dozens of other world leaders.
That is probably the case, that yes, Tsai Ing-wen placed the call, but this was arranged in advance. Apparently, there was a briefing that was given to President-elect Trump about Taiwan and cross-strait relations in advance of the call. So I'm just not completely convinced that there is absolutely nothing behind this. And of course, what we've seen actually today is that President-elect Trump is once again tweeting about China and criticizing China for its manipulation of its currency and also for building military outposts in the South China Sea. So it's beginning to look like he is trying to put pressure on China, and maybe his engagement with Taiwan is to that end.
Does this make the selection of a Secretary of State all that more important?
Well, I think it does. We keep hearing from Donald Trump new names virtually every day of who might be Secretary of State. So it appears that he is not yet settled on his choice. But it does matter who is in that position, because that person is the face of the administration. Nevertheless, the policy itself toward China, Taiwan, and others will be set, I think, by the president.
Do you anticipate any possible change in the One China policy?
I think it would be extremely surprising if the new president were to revise the One China policy. However, even within the One China policy, there could be adjustments that might be made to strengthen relations with Taiwan.
That's Bonnie Glaser, Senior Advisor for Asia and Director of the China Power Project at the Washington-based Centers for Strategic and International Studies. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what kind of reaction is all this getting on social media?
A lot of questions and a lot of speculation on whether this was an intentional phone call, an intentional change in policy, or if it's just that Donald Trump didn't know the significance of this. And that's causing a lot of concern among people as they try to ascertain which of those two this might be. So we'll still continue to monitor that as that develops. The other big story out of the president-elect's new administration this morning is his nomination of Dr. Ben Carson to be Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. Now, Ben Carson is known as a very gifted neurosurgeon, but doesn't have political experience. In fact, several weeks ago, said that he wouldn't be comfortable leading an agency because of his lack of federal government experience. But he's been nominated, and so this is causing concern among many, saying he doesn't have that experience. But others are saying, look what Donald Trump's doing. He's draining the swamp. He's bringing in new people who don't have the traditional Washington experience. And so it is, again, getting looked at in those kind of two different ways. Another big story here in the U.S., hashtag NoDAPL. Of course, that stands for the Dakota Access Pipeline. I know you have a story coming up about that. But big victory for protesters there. And they're praising that victory on social media with that hashtag. And then finally, we are later this week going to remember the 75th anniversary on the attack on Pearl Harbor, and a big announcement from Japan this morning that Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will be the first Japanese leader to visit Pearl Harbor later this month. Coupled with President Obama's trip to Hiroshima earlier this year, a lot of people noting on social media that these are two huge steps, not only in U.S.-Japan relations, but in geopolitical relations forward. So a nice announcement from him. We'll look forward to monitoring that as that happens later in the month.
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Andrew. You got a lot of information in there.
That's
that social media editor, Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A Greek court rejects the extradition of three Turkish soldiers accused in the coup attempt. A Pakistani aide in Washington wants to build on a recent conversation between President-elect Donald Trump and Pakistani Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. Left-leaning Alexander von der Bellen wins Austria's rerun presidential election, and Japan's Prime Minister Abe will visit Pearl Harbor. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Data from the July 2015 flyby of Pluto by NASA's New Horizons probe provided scientists with evidence of an ocean of water about 100 kilometers deep and lurking beneath the dwarf planet's surface. One in a series of new studies suggests that the ocean, which is thought to lie under Pluto's heart-shaped Sputnik Planitia region, may be rather toxic, salty, incredibly cold, and very rich with ammonia. While some of the scientists who developed theories of Pluto's subsurface ocean describe it as a slushy liquid, one of the authors of the new studies likens it to being more like syrup in nature. Another finding suggests that despite the theorized composition of the ocean, it just might also harbor some so far unknown and mysterious forms of life. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we visit a museum concerning inventor Thomas Edison. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has denied an easement for the highly controversial $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline. The proposal was the subject of months of protests by the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which contends the project would affect its drinking water supply and destroy its sacred sites. In a statement Sunday, the Corps of Engineers said it would be undertaking an environmental impact statement to look at possible alternative routes for the project. I spoke with VOA's Isha Sarai, who's at the site near Cannonball, North Dakota. I asked her for the reaction by the activists to the decision.
Yeah, I would say it's cautiously happy. There are definitely celebrations happening all across the camp yesterday. But, you know, everyone you talk to, their immediate reaction saying they were excited or saying they were happy about the decision was followed by, but, you know, we have to stay strong. We have to stay cautious. You know, these promises have been made to us before. And I think a lot of people know that the Army Corps now expects them to break camp, you know, seeing that in theory their mission is over, but these people have no intention of leaving. I think they're going to stay even with the winter weather just to make sure that all these promises are kept.
Wow, that's real determination because the weather is getting right. You know, winter's coming on and they're still staying there. Is it just because they don't trust the Army Corps?
I think that's it. And I mean, not necessarily the Army Corps, but looking forward, they're very aware that the federal government could reverse this decision once Trump is inaugurated in January. And, you know, I think a similar statement, not quite as strong, but a similar statement was made over Thanksgiving. And they've all been citing that as kind of a reason to need to wait it out and then be sure that this is real.
Now, why were the activists so opposed to having the pipeline go through this area?
First of all, they're citing a fear that the pipeline would break and poison the drinking water of the Missouri River. And, you know, one thing I heard a lot yesterday was people saying it's not if it breaks, it's when it breaks. These people are convinced that, you know, something is going to go wrong and their water is going to be poisoned. I believe there's an old Lakota proverb, you know, citing a time when the black snake will come and poison the water. And they're thinking of this oil pipeline as a black snake. But additionally, because there has been copious research saying that a pipeline is actually safer than the way oil is currently transported through the region, which is, you know, by truck and by train. A lot of people are also, you know, this is really a Native American issue, an issue of a people opposed on their own land, because they say that, you know, the pipeline had originally been planned to go through Bismarck, which is the nearest town. And the people of Bismarck said, no, it'll be too dangerous. So the reaction allegedly was to reroute it through Native American land.
Well, now, originally, the core of the activists were the Sioux, the Native Americans. However, a number of other people have joined them in this protest.
Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming, actually, to see the diversity at the camp. I mean, from tribes from all across the country, and even, you know, people from outside of the country. I've personally spoken with an Australian Aboriginal as well as a Maori who came all the way from New Zealand to show their support, just because this is really an Indigenous person issue to a lot of people. And additionally, there are quite a few white Americans there who are calling themselves water protectors. And, you know, whether they're standing there for the environment or in solidarity with the Native American people, or, you know, even I've even met some people who said they were just simply exhausted with post-election and the way they feel this country has begun to treat people and the environment, that they are starting to align with the beliefs of the Native Americans and are just enjoying their time living in a camp really outside of society.
That's VOA's Isha Sarai near Cannonball, North Dakota. Well, while his name is synonymous with the electric light bulb, Thomas Alva Edison also created hundreds of mechanical and electrical devices that revolutionized life for millions of people around the world. The house where Edison lived and worked is now a U.S. National Park Service site in West Orange, New Jersey. National Parks traveler Micah Meyer, who's on a mission to visit all of the more than 400 sites within the National Park Service, was there and shared highlights of his visit with VOA's Julie Tabo.
Thomas Alva Edison is considered America's greatest inventor. He's best known for creating the first long-lasting electric light bulb in 1879, but he also invented and perfected more than 1,000 other products. His favorite, historians say, was the phonograph, the first machine that could capture sound and play it back. This 1888 recording is believed to be the earliest existing recording of Thomas Edison's voice. Edison was also one of the first inventors of the motion picture camera.
I'm here at the Thomas Edison National Historical Park in New Jersey, where behind me is a three-story lab that helped produce some of Edison's most famous inventions.
National Parks traveler Micah Meyer spent a day immersing himself in Edison history at the inventor's home and laboratory.
is a fitting place to take a video on a cell phone, because if it wasn't for Edison's invention, this phone and the electricity that charges it wouldn't exist.
Much of the site has been kept intact.
He had this amazing library there that kept all of his records, and then you went right next door in the factory. Everything was in-house. So they were designing, they were building, they were shipping all from this one location.
With 400,000 artifacts and over 5 million pages of documents, the site looks very much as it did when Edison was working here. Also on the property is the Black Moriah, considered to be the world's first building constructed solely for the production of movies.
It was designed on a pivot and turn system so that it could capture the direct sunlight as easily as possible to make the films.
Edison's early attempts at movie making helped set the stage for the remarkable achievements that have been made in filmmaking since then, and made possible just about every form of digital media that permeates modern culture today. Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Kanye West has been on a personal roller coaster for the last several weeks. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald stopped by to chat with International Edition's Jim Stevenson on how Kanye is doing after his recent hospitalization interrupted his latest tour.
As I lay me down to sleep, I hear her speak to me.
The facts of the story, Jim, are pretty self-evident. He was released from the University of California, Los Angeles Medical Center after spending 9 days in the hospital. He entered the facility on November 21st. Now, those are the facts. After that, you get into some degree of speculation, because not too many sources are going on the record about this. There are privacy issues, and there's a lot of speculation as to what exactly put him in the hospital. Just before he went in the hospital, Kanye was going on extended rants and his concert appearances. And he also pulled the plug on the rest of his St. Pablo tour for the remainder of 2016. After that, there was supposedly some sort of incident at his personal trainer's house, which led to the police being called and later the fire department. Sources tell Entertainment Weekly that doctors were reluctant to diagnose anything. At the time of his admittance, the official reasons given were exhaustion and dehydration. He was placed on a psychiatric hold in the hospital for his own protection. A source said West had suffered a mental breakdown while showing signs of paranoia, and that his wife Kim Kardashian was the only person that he trusted. Kim evidently stayed with Kanye for most of the time that he was in the hospital. Entertainment Tonight quotes a source as saying West was also showing signs of stress following Kim's robbery in Paris. Back in September, you might remember
that was a big deal.
Some thieves held her hostage in her residence and made off with a lot of jewelry. And understandably, she's been traumatized by the incident. And beyond that, sources close to Kanye West say he's never completely recovered from the sudden death of his mother back in 2007. He and his mother, Donda, were very, very close. And, of course, it's been, a whirlwind of activity for Kanye West in the last 10 years. He's become a superstar. He married Kim Kardashian. He's never really been out of the public eye. And it's probably a combination of these and possibly some other things that we don't know about that put him in the hospital.
It doesn't seem to matter who the entertainer is these days. A lot of pressure is out there on people who are constantly in the public eye. And we've seen this manifest in different ways with other high-profile performers.
Mm-hmm. And exhaustion and dehydration are often the boilerplate answers for when performers choose to retire from the scene for a while, or when they're hospitalized, or when they go off the road. And there are so many reasons contributing to that.
And sometimes in these situations, we've seen where artists have kind of, regrouped in private. These experiences have led them to some artistic brilliance later down the road. And then the anticipation among their fans of them returning kind of builds things up again.
That's exactly right. And that's what we may see with Kanye West. He may choose to just go underground for a while and reemerge with a brilliant new album and possibly a tour.
We wish him all the best, and we wish Ray all the best each and every week. He's out here with the Top 20 Countdown on VOA 1. You can also catch Ray
on my Twitter feed at Ray on the Hits.
Love to follow it. Thank you so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim. Thanks.
And that is our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
When appropriate and in accordance with U.S. law, the United States identifies certain individuals as crucial to the operation of terrorist organizations. Most often, these are top leaders, or they help finance terrorist organizations. When such an individual is identified, the U.S. government places that person's name on the specially designated nationals list. His assets within U.S. reach are immediately frozen, locked out of the global financial network. No U.S. citizen or company may conduct business with a designated individual. Such is the case of Victor Quispe Palomino, Jorge Quispe Palomino, and Tarsela Loya Vilches, three top leaders of Peruvian-based foreign terrorist organization and specially designated global terrorist group, Shining Path. Shining Path, which has been engaged in terrorism since 1980, is a violent offshoot of the Communist Party of Peru. Its stated intent is to violently overthrow the country's long-standing democracy and replace it with a Maoist-style dictatorship. It employs intimidation, assassination, and particularly brutal and murderous attacks on civilians to achieve its aims. These terrorists have massacred entire villages. This includes, among others, Lucanamarca, where 69 people were massacred in 1983, and the subsequent Huatlo massacre that killed 47. Shining Path finances itself through the cocaine trade. It taxes the cultivation, processing, and transit of cocaine. It also provides transport and armed security to narcotics trafficking organizations, moving large cocaine loads through and out of South Central Peru. Brothers Victor and Jorge Quispe Palomino currently lead the Shining Path group. Victor Quispe Palomino has admitted to participating in the Lucanamarca massacre, while his brother Jorge has also participated in and directed Shining Path attacks that resulted in numerous deaths. Tarsela Loya Vilches is in charge of the military training and ideological indoctrination of children. She is known to have trained new Shining Path members, often child soldiers, to serve as reinforcements in the group's terrorist operations. For these and other reasons, all three have been designated by the U.S. Department of State as specially designated global terrorists under Executive Order 13224. Since 1980, Peruvians have strongly rejected the Shining Path, and what is left of the organization has evolved into little more than a violent, criminal, narco-terrorist gang. By now designating its remaining leadership, the United States hopes to disrupt the group's ability to continue its nefarious activities.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.